Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety 2, the safe space created for Black women, by Black women, to strip away the taboo of talking about mental health. You'll hear from mental health professionals and advocates, as well as Black women sharing their experiences as we break down the complexities, explore ways to heal, and support each other. My name is Ashley, I'm your host. Whether you're a seasoned regular or this is your first time tuning in, thank you so much for your support. Now let's get into today's episode. Welcome back to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety 2. I'm your host, Ashley, and I hope that y'all are having a good summer, spring, fall, winter, whenever you listen to this. I hope you're having a wonderful day so far. I'm back again. We're going to have a great conversation today with somebody that I've been really looking forward to interviewing. We had a really great conversation call before the recording that was just... I'm just excited. Y'all, as much as I love the educational episodes, some of my favorite episodes are the ones where I'm just talking to like everyday Black women that want to talk about mental health. And so we're going to welcome Stacey Bryce to the podcast. So welcome to the pod, Stacey.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, I'm happy that you're here. I'm excited for this conversation. I'm going to tell y'all a little bit about Stacey, and then we're going to let her tell a little bit about herself in Fast and Curious. But before we get into that, so Stacey, I know you're a Carolina girl. Are you North Carolina or South Carolina?
A little bit of both. I was born and raised in South Carolina, but I spent my adult years in North Carolina.
Okay. All right. What part of North Carolina?
Charlotte.
Okay. I know Charlotte a little bit. I know Charlotte. Do you have a favorite, North Carolina or South Carolina?
I'll say North Carolina.
Yeah?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So Stacey is a Carolina girl. She's now living in Maryland. She's a licensed master social worker with 11 years of social work experience. She has worked with the homeless population, adolescents, and children in various capacities, as well as various aspects of mental health. She is now a full-time therapist. She took a short hiatus from social work at the end of 2015 to pursue a career in education. She's taught elementary school for 5 years before returning to social work in 2022. In her spare time, she enjoys watching TV. We're going to have to get some shows from you, reading. We're going to have to get some books from you, and listening to podcasts. Spending time with her husband and cat. And by the way, what's your cat's name, Stacey?
Cat.
I love that. That is like the best thing I've heard all day. I love that. And Cat is super, super cute. I wish y'all could see. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, there'll be a YouTube channel and you can actually see Cat. She's really adorable. But Stacey, thank you so much for coming on the pod. Like I said, I love all the education episodes, and we're still going to get some of that today. But I love the episodes where we just kind of like do a personal deep dive. And Stacey, you've been doing all the things. You've worked in lots of different settings, which is awesome. You've been doing a lot of work when it comes to social work, to working with children, to working with the homeless population. So I have so many questions for you. But before we get to those questions, we are going to jump into Fast and Curious.
Okay.
Now, Stacey, I feel like you already know what Fast and Curious is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Stacey might listen to the podcast a little bit, which I love. I love when we can have people from the community on the podcast. So thank you for listening. I appreciate you. But for anybody that's new and you never listened to an episode before, welcome, number one. I didn't even say welcome at the beginning, but welcome to Black Girls Have Anxiety 2. And Fast and Curious is where we have a little fun. We spend 3 minutes where I throw crazy random questions at my guests, and we either get a quick answer or a story. You ready?
Yes.
Okay, it's going to be about 3 minutes. Here we go. If you could spend a year as any animal in the world, what animal would you be?
A cat.
A cat.
No doubt.
Yeah? Like any particular type of cat or just like cat?
Probably a lion.
Yeah, I love that.
And I'm also a Leo. My birthday is in August.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Well, your birthday's coming up. Happy pre-birthday.
Thank you.
A lion. That's a good choice. What's the first thing you would do as a lion?
Eat.
You're trying to go find food. The first thing, like the, are you going to go for like a giraffe or like a, what else do lions eat?
Bison?
Bison? They, yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay. I love that because that would be fun. You get to chase things around.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. Okay. Have you ever seen a lion in real life?
No, I haven't. Well, at the zoo, but yeah. Not like...
Not safari type.
Yeah.
Yeah, me neither. I want to do that one day. What is on your cell phone wallpaper?
Ooh. My... Let me see. Just some bubbles.
Oh, cute. It's colorful with a little black background. I like it. Cute.
Just some bubbles.
What is your favorite time of year? Fall, spring, summer, or winter?
Fall.
Fall. What's your favorite part about fall?
It's cool. It's relaxing. It's football season. I'm not a football watcher, but it just seemed like football season is just so relaxed and chilled out.
Yeah. Football season is pretty chill.
Mm-hmm.
Unless there's people that are just like the fans that go, like they got the jerseys and the, that's kind of fun too, but yeah, some people are like, it's intense.
Yeah.
You can only watch it with so many people, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you could hang out with any cartoon character, or let's just say any fictional character from TV shows, who would you hang out with? And you got like a, you know, y'all are going to go out to like go eat or something like that.
I think, okay, so the TV show Suits, the head lawyer, she was a black lady played by Gina Torres, I think that was her name.
Okay.
I would go out with her. She also plays on 911 Lone Star. She's the captain. So I would go out with her.
I love that. So what is your favorite TV show?
Ooh.
That's a hard one, right? Because now there's so many choices nowadays.
I'm going to go with Shameless.
That's such a good TV show. Have you seen every season?
Yes.
I think I've only not seen the last season. Like, what is it, season 8? I think they're at right now.
I think it's like 9 or 10.
Oh, well, I'm behind. Because I think the last one I saw was season 8. That show is just pure chaos, and I can't
dysfunction.
Stop watching. Dysfunction and chaos, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure as a therapist, you probably see that through a whole different light.
Yep.
If you could live in any country for 6 months, where would you live?
Ghana.
Oh, I love that. Yes.
I've been wanting to go to Ghana forever, but I just haven't made it yet.
Oh. Yes, same. Ghana is on my list. It's high up on my list. So one of these days, we're going to get over there.
Mm-hmm.
One of these days. If you could write a book that was about your life, what would you name the book?
The Joys and Woes of Stacy.
Ooh, that sounds like a bestseller. I would read it. I would definitely read it. The Joys and Woes of Stacy. Ooh, I like that. Okay, what is your favorite thing to cook?
Ooh, okay. So I don't cook much.
Mm-hmm. Or favorite thing to eat?
My favorite thing to eat would be pizza.
Ooh,
I love pizza. Anything with meats, and it has to have pineapples on top of.
Yes. If I can give you a high five, I would give you a high five.
High five.
I'm all for pineapple on pizza. And if you're listening and you don't like pineapple on pizza, it's because you haven't tried a good one.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have good pineapple, and the sauce has to be really good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, now I'm hungry. Okay. Now I gotta stop. Okay, last question. If you could... if the aliens came down right now and they said, Stacy, I can give you a ticket. It's a round trip ticket. You can come home. But I give you a ticket to go spend a year to where I just came from. Are you taking the ticket? You could bring a couple people if you want to. And you could bring Kat.
Probably not. I'll stay here on Earth. Yeah, I'm not going.
Oh, man. Okay, well, thank you, Stacy, for playing Fast and Curious with me. Mm-hmm. That was good. And Stacy said no to the aliens. Y'all can keep the planets. She's going to stay right here in Maryland. Mm-hmm. We are going to hop into our mind games segment. And so for anybody that's new to the podcast, the mind games segment is just a segment where we play a little bit of trivia. And I usually give you a mental health disorder and I give you the description of it. And y'all have to guess the name of it. We're going to switch it up a little bit today. And we are actually going to do a Who Am I segment. Of a Who Am I version of mind games. That basically means I'm going to read the description in first person of the person that I'm talking about. And I'll give you a little hint. This person has made major contributions to mental health. So, Stacy, you ready?
I'm ready.
You might know who it is, so don't tell everybody, Stacy.
Okay.
All right. So, I am often referred to as the godfather of black psychology. I am an influential African-American psychologist and activist. I was born in 1932 in Lincoln, Nebraska, and passed away in 2017. I was one of the first African-Americans to earn a PhD in clinical psychology that I obtained from Michigan State University and faced significant racial barriers during my academic and professional journey. I co-founded the Association of Black Psychologists, or ABPSI, in 1968, a professional organization dedicated to promoting psychological research, practice, and education that addresses the needs of African Americans and other marginalized populations. Throughout my career, I advocated for greater diversity and inclusion within the field of psychology and pushed for increased representation of minority psychologists in leadership roles, promoted the recruitment and training of students from underrepresented backgrounds, and challenged discriminatory practices in academia and mental health institutions. I'm a prolific writer and speaker, and my name is... I'm not going to tell y'all to the end. So you got to stick around to the end of the episode. I'll come back and I'll actually tell you who it is. Stacy, do you think you know who it is?
I have no clue.
No clue? Okay. That's okay. This is a new person to me too. So I'll make sure we circle back at the end and I'll tell y'all who it is. All right. So Stacy, I know that you have a background, obviously, in mental health as a mental health professional. You've worked mm-hmm. in a school setting. You've worked in social work setting. So can you tell me a little bit about maybe can you tell us a little bit about some of the settings that you've worked in?
I've done a lot. So I've worked in a prison psychiatric hospital. I worked in a homeless shelter. I worked in schools as a school therapist. I worked in alternative schools as a counselor. I worked in psychiatric residential facilities as a counselor. So most of my experience has been with adolescents, for the most part, has been with adolescents.
Is that what you had originally planned on, like when you were studying to get into mental health? Is that you wanted to work with adolescents?
Well, long story short, I initially wanted to be a teacher because I wanted to be a teacher like the teacher I had growing up, you know, who made an impact on me, who helped students like me because I came from a lower income neighborhood. So I guess looking back now, I guess I did do the things I planned to do by working with those students because that's what I initially wanted to do from the beginning. So I guess it worked out.
Yeah, it definitely worked out now. So I want to talk a little bit about, like, of course, one thing I always think about when I speak with mental health professionals, especially Black women, like, how do you take care of your own mental health while also trying to kind of help everybody else take care of their mental health? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I set boundaries. Like, when I get off of work, I leave my work bag in the car. I don't bring out the bag. I don't bring out the phone. I don't take anything into the house. I know how to say no. I can shut everything down. Like, I like to watch TV, read books, and listen to podcasts. So that's some of the things that I would do to kind of separate my work life from my home life. I just shut it off.
Was that hard at first? Like, because obviously now you're like, I'm going to set my boundaries. I have no fear of saying no. Like, was there like a turning point at some point where you're like, okay, I have to separate work from home? Because I can imagine, especially working with kids, when it comes to like children and helping them with their mental health, I can imagine it's really easy to start taking things home. So was there a point that you started kind of creating that boundary?
Mm-hmm. Like years ago when I was early in social work, you know, I used to take work home with me. I would have like the on-call phone. I would be answering the phone calls, going in after hours, and it was a lot. So this time, the second go-round in social work, I decided to set boundaries. So it's a lot easier now that I'm older, Stacy, than what I was when I was in my 20s trying to be a social worker back then when I wanted to save everybody and help the world.
That's got to be hard, though, like, because you do want to save everybody in that position. But now it's like, it seems like you have done a lot of thought and like work behind, okay, I'm going to be intentional and set this boundary in these particular ways. And how do you deal with it? Like when work doesn't necessarily respect those boundaries and maybe calls you after hours, like, do you have like a conversation with them, or like, what does that look like? Cause I know boundaries are great, but it's sometimes the hardest part of a boundary isn't setting it, is keeping it.
So thankfully with the current job I have, I don't really have those issues because I work in a school setting. So when school gets out at 4, I'm done. So I don't have to worry about anything afterwards. Previous jobs, like I said, I struggled because I wanted to be captain, save everybody. So I wanted to help everybody. So in previous jobs, you know, and when I say previous, I mean like before I was a teacher, because I was a teacher in between the two social work careers I had. But previously, I wanted to help everybody. So it was a struggle to try to limit myself to my job, because I would get calls, I would get phone calls, and, you know, they would call me to come in and different things like that. So it's just easier now with the job I have compared to the jobs I've had in the past.
Is there I know you've worked in different settings, right? Is there a particular setting that is your favorite, has been like your favorite to work in?
Working at the homeless shelter with the men, I think that would be my favorite, because it was so many different personalities, so many different people, you know, just seeing some of the guys come in who didn't have anything. And then now they come to me like, you know, look, Stacy, I got a job now. I have a car. I'm moving into my place. So just to see that transformation with the guys, I would say the shelter would have been my favorite job.
That's awesome. And like, thank you for doing that work, because I think sometimes the homeless population is forgotten often, you know, especially when it comes to mental health. Like, I feel like nowadays we're moving forward when it comes to mental health, but oftentimes the homeless population is forgotten in so many ways, right? Shelter, food, access to healthcare, but particularly access to mental health care. So the fact that you were doing the work in that setting. Like, I want to give my kudos to you.
Thank you.
That's amazing. I want to talk a little bit about kind of how you deal with your own, not how you deal with your own mental health, but I know when we spoke, you shared something with me, and I think for me, it's important that people understand that people that are mental health professionals, whether you're like a licensed social worker, a therapist, a psychologist, that at the end of the day, you're still a human being. Like, you are still a Black woman that goes home, and you're a Black woman after work, before work, doing work, all of those times. But you're also a human that's having their own mental health experience as well. Can you tell us something about, I know that we talked about your diagnosis, but can you talk about like your diagnosis and how it, like the day that you received your diagnosis?
I think it was a breakup. It was something about a man that had caused me to go into a, I can't think of the word, but it just caused me to go into a haywire, for lack of a better word. And I was a frequent flyer to EAP, Employee Assistance Program, because I thought that was therapy. So thankfully, all of the jobs I've had, I had EAP. So I would go to EAP whenever I would have an issue. And, you know, I just thought that was therapy. So one day, because of a man, we broke up or something happened. I don't even remember the details anymore. I went to EAP, and I was talking to the therapist, and I was explaining to him what was going on, how I was feeling, my ups, my downs, my behaviors, all of those different things. And he said, it sounds like you might have bipolar type 2. And because I was already familiar with mental health diagnosis from being in social work, taking psychopathology and all of those different things, it kind of caught me off guard because I knew what bipolar was. And I was like, well, my highs aren't high enough to be bipolar. So he explained to me that it's a difference between mania and hypomania. And what I was experiencing as someone with bipolar type 2 was hypomania. So he referred me to a psychiatrist where I got my official diagnosis, and it went from there.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing about your diagnosis. I think sometimes, and this is probably on me, I don't ask people enough about, like, how did you get your diagnosis? What kind of sparked your, you know, did somebody like you, where you were, you had confided with somebody and they kind of gave you, planted the seed a little bit and like, hey, maybe let's explore this and see if this is something that is actually a diagnosis for you. For anybody that's listening, it's like, I've heard of bipolar disorder. I don't really know what it is. I didn't know there was two types of bipolar disorder. Are there more? I'm going to actually give y'all just a quick rundown of what bipolar disorder is. And this is, I'm pulling this from psychiatry.org. Y'all know I'll put the description in the episode. Hey, Kat. So I'm going to give y'all the definition, and then I'm going to go through type 1 and type 2 just briefly, just so y'all kind of have an idea of bipolar disorder and like the official definition. So it is a brain disorder that causes changes in a person's mood, energy, and ability to function. People with bipolar disorder experience intense emotional states that typically occur during distinct periods of days to weeks called mood episodes. These mood episodes are categorized as manic and hypomanic, similar to what Stacey was just talking about, or abnormally happy or irritable mood, or depressive slash sad mood. So people with bipolar disorder generally have periods of neutral mood as well. When treated, people with bipolar disorder, or BPD, as some people call it, can lead full and productive lives, as we see Stacey is doing all the things all the time in different settings. Bipolar disorder is a category that includes three different diagnoses. The first is bipolar 1, the second is bipolar 2, and the third is I'm going to hope I'm pronouncing this right. Cyclothymic disorder. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Stacey. I'm like, did I say that right? Bipolar disorder commonly runs in families. 80 to 90% of individuals with BPD have a relative that also has BPD or depression. Average onset of bipolar disorder is 25 years old. Bipolar disorder 1, type 1, is diagnosed when a person experiences a manic episode. During that manic episode, people with BPD experience an extreme increase in energy and may feel on top of the world or uncomfortably, irritable in mood. They may also experience depressive or hypomanic disorders. And then, let me scroll down here. So a hypomanic episode is characterized by less severe manic symptoms that need to last only 4 days in a row rather than a week. Hypomanic symptoms do not lead to major problems in daily functioning that manic symptoms typically cause. Now, bipolar 2. This bipolar 2 requires someone to have at least one major depressive episode and at least one hypomanic episode. People usually return to their usual functionings between episodes. They typically first seek treatment for depressive episode, since hypomanic episodes often feel pleasurable and can even increase performance. I will make sure. And cyclothymic disorder, just a quick little bit about that. It's a milder form of bipolar disorder, including many mood swings with hypomania and depressive symptoms that occur frequently. People with cyclothymia experience emotional ups and downs, but with less severe symptoms than bipolar 1 or bipolar 2. Mm-hmm. Whew. I hope I didn't run through that too fast. So I want to go back, Stacey, and go back to, for you now, you go to the doctor and you receive your diagnosis. How did you feel when you received the diagnosis, like over that next week, month, whatever it may be?
Before we go there, I want to go back to what you mentioned about the age limit that it usually, onset. You said 25, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was in my late 20s when I started noticing something was different, but I didn't get diagnosed until I was 32. So it was like a five year difference between, you know, living the life and knowing something is wrong and actually getting a diagnosis. So it was just, it was a wild 5 years.
Was there,
but,
go ahead, Stacey.
Oh, go ahead.
So that during that 5 years, it sounds like you may have noticed your behavior was changing, but didn't mm-hmm. quite know what that meant. What kind of behaviors changed in that 5 years?
I was irritable all the time. I always wanted to fight. Like I said, I worked at a men's shelter. So every time somebody pissed me off, I wanted to fight. Mm-hmm. I was hypersexual, so I was having a lot of sex with a lot of different people. What else was going on? I couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. Like, I could go days without sleeping. So those when I was in my hypomanic state. And then when I was in depression, I couldn't go to work. I would just lay in the bed all day. I couldn't eat, and I would be like that for days.
I want to go back to, excuse me, because I think I think that it was probably, was it easier to realize, like, I'm feeling depressed rather than some of the other behavior changes that happened?
Yes. Yeah. Depression was much easier to identify than hypomanic, because I was familiar with bipolar and depression, anxiety, and all of those good things. Because I have a background in social work and I took the classes and I kept thinking maybe I have bipolar. But then I was like, well, it can't be bipolar because I don't have delusions. I don't have you know, a sense of grandiosity. I didn't have the highs like bipolar has. I was like, well, it can't be bipolar, but I didn't know about bipolar type 2. Mm. So
I feel like we don't talk as much about bipolar 2 or cyclothymic disorder, mm-hmm. because I feel like oftentimes we hear about bipolar 1, type 1, and I've had a few people on the podcast that have bipolar type 1. And so, like you mentioned, those feelings of, like, grandiosity or, like, those extreme highs, mm-hmm. almost to the point where, man, especially if you're an artist, you're creating, you would think, like, oh, this is great. Like, I'm feeling amazing. And then the extreme lows. So I want to go back to, like, those feelings of, like, extreme irritability and kind of, like, having, like, a response where you're trying to fight somebody, like, you're pissing me off, and now I want to, let's mm-hmm. tussle. Like, when did you realize, like, oh my gosh, why am I having this reaction when I didn't have a reaction to these things before?
That's a good question. I guess when it started to become a common thing, like when it was just like all the time, like before, maybe once or twice it was okay, but then all the time I wanted to fight, like all the time I was irritable, all the time I was making bad decisions, like I wanted to move from North Carolina to South Carolina, but still work in North Carolina. Like, I was doing some of the most random things because I just wasn't all the way there, for lack of a better word, if that makes sense.
Yeah, kind of going through those changes, but not realizing that your body is going through, like, these cycles of change. I know you also mentioned, like, the hypersexuality part. And I think that's also a piece that we don't talk about enough. Mm-hmm. And not many people will associate hypersexuality with a particular mental health disorder. I feel like that's kind of like a weird zone to be in, because you don't want to disrespect somebody if that's, like, that is their choice and that is what they are doing. And it has nothing to do with a mental health disorder. But for you, it sounds like there was a shift of maybe you weren't hypersexual, and then in your late 20s, that became a part of your life.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it.
And did at that point, so like your, did that just become hypersexual with, like, you've just met a random person and, like, relationships were pursued really quickly? What did that look like, if you don't mind sharing?
It could have been, you know, back then I was on a dating site. So I was on Plenty of Fish and OkCupid. And it was another one, I forgot. But, you know, I would meet guys and then, you know, it would be, we may go on a date and the date may turn into something sexual. Or we may not even go on a date and it just turn into something sexual. So it was a lot of sex, unfortunately.
Was that something in the moment, like after it had happened, were you like, I actually didn't really want to do that? Or was that after a period of time, then you realize, okay, this is something that I'm doing and I don't think that I want it to necessarily be part of my life? Like, when did you realize it was a problem for you?
The second thing you just said, after a while, it's like, okay, well, Stacey, it's been so many guys in such a small amount of time, no relationships, just different guys you're meeting online and you having sexual relationships with them, something is wrong. It's a problem.
Did anybody, like, in your support system or, like, your family, your friends, did anybody else notice, like, this, like, swing in your mood changes or swing in, like, your behaviors?
I think my family did notice, because eventually I moved back from North Carolina to South Carolina. And I had a job and everything was good. And then I just stopped going to work because I was depressed. I just couldn't get out of bed. You know, I eventually lost my job. I eventually lost my apartment. I had to live with my family members. So they was able to see that, you know, my, I don't want to say downfall, but they was able to see that downfall because I wasn't able to function. Like, I had no pep in my step. It was just real, you know, all, flat.
So I want to go back to hypomania and depression. Again, because with bipolar 2, hypomania seems to be more of the focus rather than the hypermania in bipolar 1. So for your hypomania, did you start to notice the chunks of time? Because I know for some people it could be like a certain number of days or it could be a certain number of weeks. Did you notice like, okay, I'm having these behaviors for a month and then I kind of like go back to neutral?
Not really. I didn't really notice like time frames. I just noticed like the different things I would do. Like I think I told you when we talked on the phone, like one thing, I always struggle with my weight. So one night I decided I was going to lose weight. I was going to go to Walmart. I was going to get healthy foods. I was going to get workout clothes. I was going to get workout videos. I was going to do all of these different things, which is normal. That's normal. But when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you trying to do all of these things at Walmart, that's where the abnormality come in at. So that's where hypomania can look normal. But when you really examine it, it looks like, okay, well, it's something else going on with it, something more. Because, like I said, that's normal stuff that you can do, but you're not doing it at 3 o'clock in the morning trying to lose weight, and you have to be to work at 7 o'clock in the morning.
So that night that you did that, that looked like 2:30 comes around, and you just get this idea, and then you're like, I'm going to, like, clean out all the stuff that I don't want to eat, and then I'm going to, like, get in my car, drive to Walmart in the middle of the night. And so at that point, I'm assuming, like, you're feeling good. Like, yes. You're excited. You're like, I'm going to do all these things. So when you did that, did you sleep? Like, once you went to Walmart, did your shopping, carts full, you get home, did you sleep? Or were you still like, okay, now I've got to, like, work out, or I've got to, like, go online and do more research? What did that rest of that night look like for you?
Work out, more research. I didn't sleep.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't sleep at all.
And then when you got up to and went to work, did you tell anybody else about what you did? Like, did you share that?
No.
No?
Yeah, no.
Wow. And so did that happen, like, when you, like, the next day, did you stay up all night again? Was that, like, a sequential thing over time?
Yeah, because like I said, I struggle with my sleep, so it would be days that I would go without sleeping when I was in a hypomanic state.
Wow.
So it would be days, and I would have so much energy. Like, I'm a writer. Well, I used to be a writer, so I would be up all night writing stories and writing books and poems and... Wow. Everything. Just, I had all the energy in the world just to do everything.
Yeah. I feel like, Stacey, I'm going to just let you know, I feel like once you're a writer, even if you haven't picked up a pen in a few years, you're always a writer.
Yeah.
I'm going to give that one to you. Because I think that's a talent that it doesn't matter if it's been 15 years or 15 days, I feel like you're still a writer. But is that, so you would go days without sleeping?
Mm-hmm.
And still be going to work. Then you get home and, like, find this new thing that you're kind of, like, hyper-focused on, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. And then that's the hypomania. Then comes does the depression come right after that? Or is that, can it be broken up with, like, okay, now I'm kind of, like, back to my neutral point?
I think it would go back to neutral, then depression. And depression will always last longer than a hypomania.
Yeah, depression. How long does it usually last for you?
Maybe like a week or two. And a hypomania will last a few days.
Okay. So you go through this hypomanic episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe like a week or 2 weeks of kind of like if things are normal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get hit with a depression. Do you know like when depression's coming on? Like are there some things, some signs that your body starts to do or your mind starts to do where you're like, all right, it's coming, it's hitting me again?
When I can't go to work, when I start thinking mm-hmm. like, okay, I can't go to work today, and I call out. So when I start calling out from work, that's when depression starting to come in and starting to kick in.
Mm. And I know depression can look like different things for most people, but I know it seems like for you, it's just wanting to be at home and kind of like disengage with the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you still like, do you answer phone calls during your depression? Do you still eat? Because I know sometimes people like have changes with the way they eat. Maybe some people don't eat at all. Some people like kind of fixate on like one particular thing that they want to eat. Some people like me, I don't answer my phone. I just be swerving people, to be honest. But how does that look for you?
For me, I just kind of shut everything out. I don't answer the phone. I barely eat. I just shut everything out. And it's funny, but it's not funny. Many years ago when I was going through a depression, for some reason, like my friends kept reaching out to me. And for some reason, they thought I passed away.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, because I wasn't answering the phone. I wasn't really talking to anybody. But for some reason, they thought I passed away. And I was like, oh, wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
How did they realize that you were still there?
I eventually answered the phone.
After like a week or 2 weeks?
Yeah, like after about 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming at this point, were you in Maryland at this point? Or you were like away from where your friends are, where they could kind of like just drive and make sure you're good?
I was in North Carolina, but at that point, most of my friends had moved away. So I had friends in Texas, Georgia, Charleston, Columbia. I didn't have a lot of friends in Charlotte where I was staying at the moment.
Wow. So they must have been very worried about you at this mm-hmm. point.
Yeah.
Wow. Was there ever a point where your friends pulled you aside and was like, hey, Stacy, something's changing. Like, do you need help? Did you ever have that?
I think so, yeah. I've had a few friends that did reach out to me like that. Yeah, I did. And I think another thing that kind of sparked, like I said, in my late 20s, early 30s, that's when I kind of knew something was wrong. But another thing that kind of sparked my downfall was when my friends moved away. I was so used to seeing them every day. And now, you know, my support system is gone. So mm-hmm. that was heartbreaking for me as well.
Wow. That is, yeah, that's got to be hard. Because then you're really kind of isolated at that
point. Yeah.
So I want to go back to, you know, we've talked about what life looked like prior to your diagnosis. Once you went and saw the doctor, I'm assuming, did they give you some options of like, here are some ways that we can treat it? And how did you feel about those treatments? What worked for you? What have you tried since then?
Mainly it's been medication and therapy. Mm-hmm. The first few pills, the first few medications I took didn't work. I mean, they worked, but it wasn't, the side effects was off. I've been taking Abilify for maybe 4 or 5 years, and it's been working for me. I also struggle with anxiety. I know we haven't talked about that, but I struggle with anxiety, so I take Klonopin as needed. Unfortunately, I've been going through a depression, you know, now. I've been going through a depression, so I've been taking depression and anxiety. So I've been taking my Abilify I take Abilify every day, but I've been taking more Klonopin for my anxiety.
So you kind of have a better, like a good idea at this point of like what works for me, what doesn't work for me, And then it also sounds like you're very aware of, like, okay, I'm in a depression. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna need some type of intervention, therapy, and whatever medication seems like works best for you, right?
Right.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that, because I think not everybody wants to share that they take medication, but I think it's really important for people to know that there are a lot of options out there. I want to go back to, you said that you had some side effects with some other medications. Do you mind talking a little bit about some of those side effects and, like, when you noticed them?
I'm already a heavy girl, so weight gain was a side effect. Headaches, blurred vision.
Was that like extreme blurred vision, or was it like subtle?
It was subtle.
Okay.
Yeah, it was subtle. Like things ahead of me would be blurry. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Yeah, like short distance.
Yeah, yeah.
Ah.
What else? Like I said, weight gain, blurred vision, headaches, irritability. That comes a lot with the medications I've been taking. That's a side effect. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can think of at the moment.
Okay. Does that, when you started to notice those, did you go back to, like, your psychologist and say, hey, did you kind of advocate for yourself and say, like, this is what I'm feeling, maybe this doesn't work for me? What did that look like? Because I know some people take medication for their mental health, but I don't think that people realize that you can speak up and say if you're feeling something different. It doesn't necessarily mean you don't want to take any medication, but you should be making your doctor aware of the things that you're going through so that you can find something that's a better intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So what did that conversation? Yeah, go ahead.
At some point, I actually changed my psychiatrist because he was an older white male, and nothing against older white male, but I didn't feel like he understood me as much as I needed somebody to understand me who was prescribing me with medication. So I switched to a female practice. I wanted a black female, but my first meeting was with the black psychiatrist, and she was explaining a lot of things to me about how sometimes as black people, we have lack of vitamin D, and a lot of different things that she was telling me, and it made sense. But that was just the first meeting with her. So my actual my nurse practitioner was a white lady, and we connected, and she was able to help me, you know, learn more about my body and learn more about the medication I was taking. And that's how I ended up on Abilify, which is the medication I take now.
That's number one, good for you for realizing that first person that you were seeing was not a good fit.
Yeah.
Because it's hard. Like, if you are not somebody that typically speaks up for yourself, like, I know for you, you've got boundaries set. You're like, I'm not afraid to say no. I've got lines in the sand. Do not cross them. But I think for a lot of people, it's already hard enough to go get mental help.
Mm-hmm.
That's a brave thing in and of itself to go have somebody say, hey, maybe we need to, you know, maybe something is different about me and we need to figure out how to treat it. But to then go to that same person and say, hey, this is actually not a good fit. I got to find somebody else. And there's work involved in, like, now you got to do research, especially if you're trying to find a black mental health professional or black psychiatrist or psychologist, plus a black woman that's a psychologist or psychiatrist. And then for anybody that's in communities within the black community, like the LGBTQ community, the disabled community, I mean, those are all different factors that only make it more difficult to find people that look like us in these spaces. So kudos to you for being diligent about finding a practice that works for you, and finding a group of people that understand you and are listening and can basically, like, support you through this journey. So I just want to say, good job on that, because we don't get enough credit for that.
Yeah. And now,
go ahead, Stacey.
Now here in Maryland, I do have a black nurse, psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I have a black therapist as well.
Mm. Shout out to all the black therapists out there. So you have gone through this journey and now you have a support system in play. I want to go back to the medicine just a little bit and talk about some of the, obviously there's side effects, but I want to talk about some of the benefits or some of the good ways that medicine has helped you.
Okay, so it balances me out. Like, I'm not up and down and up and down. I'm like balanced, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm balanced. With the anxiety meds I take as needed, they kind of help me overcome the anxiety a little bit when I take them. What else?
I know you said you take the anxiety medication, Abilify, and then you said that you have a medicine that also helps with depression as well.
Yeah, so Abilify is like a, it's like a psychotic medication, I believe it is, and it works for depression and hypomania.
Okay.
And then I take Klonopin for anxiety, and I take that as needed.
Okay, got it. Those names always, like, I struggle with the names. But that is, I'm glad that you have found that to be helpful. For anybody that is listening that, excuse me, for anybody that's listening that may be thinking, okay, Stacey is a mental health professional, you're a licensed social worker, you're also a therapist, now you're seeing a psychiatrist for medication. I just want to put like a little asterisk here, a little star for people that are listening that may not be as familiar with all the different types of mental health professionals that there are out there as some of like my regular listeners may be. Only certain people can prescribe you medication. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a psychiatrist. That's going to be a psychiatric nurse practitioner. I feel like I'm missing one. I think your family doctor, your like, primary care can prescribe you certain things. But when it comes to SSRIs or medications that are specifically for the support of mental health disorders, you have to go through a psychiatrist, through a nurse practitioner, a psychiatric nurse practitioner to get these things. Yes, even if you are a therapist, even if you are a mental health professional, you still have to go down these avenues to the people that specialize in medication. Mm-hmm. So I just want to call that out for anybody listening. Mm-hmm. Stacey, I know that you also mentioned that you also go to therapy and that that's been kind of part of your toolbox since your diagnosis. Can you talk about how therapy has helped?
You broke up. I didn't hear you.
Did I? Oh, I'm sorry. Let me mark that real quick. 52. Just ignore this little chat that I'm about to write here. Mm-hmm. That is... Oops. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry about that. I don't know what's going on with my mic. I might be moving around too much. Stacey, I know therapy is another big part of the way that you manage your bipolar disorder and your mental health as a whole. Mm-hmm. What is like your favorite part of therapy?
Getting to talk and just vent everything out. Just letting everything go.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part.
Do you have any advice for somebody that may have recently just been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and maybe kind of struggling as like, okay, I have this new diagnosis. Like, do you have any advice for that person?
It gets better. once you put in the resources you need, the support system, it gets better. It gets a lot better.
And just one more thing, as far as your support system now, because I imagine that there was a point that you had to then, you didn't have to, but that you might have started sharing this with the people that you love, the people that love you. What did that look like, and how do they support you in your mental health journey?
So a lot of my friends are also mental health professionals in some shape, form, or fashion. So when I disclosed it to them, they was like, oh, okay, I get it now. I understand now, because they could see my behaviors and my actions. They was able to understand a little bit more of what was going on. My family, it took them a little bit of time to understand, because they not familiar with mental health, because you know it's taboo in the Black community. Like I think you mentioned earlier that most people who have bipolar, somebody else in their family also has it. I believe it's undiagnosed in my family, so I can't really call and say who has it, because I think it's undiagnosed. So, you know, a lot of times in the Black community, in my family, it was more so pray about it. Yeah, more so pray about it than anything else.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing in our community. I think just talking about the fact that some of these bipolar disorder and other mental health disorders, they do tend to run in families. And it's like it's a weird position to be in of like, hey, I just received this diagnosis and I know I had the stat here. I think it was like there's an 80 to 90% chance that somebody else in your family has it. Don't quote me on that. I'm going to share the link. But that's a hard position to be in, because there might be somebody in your family that has similar behaviors. And I can imagine, Stacey, for you, that's got to be an interesting position to be in, because here you are doing the work, because you're like, I am acknowledging mental health as a thing and I'm going to find the resources and I feel better. Like, I feel like I'm able to live life differently in a way that works better for me. And so is that hard to maybe see other people in your family that possibly may share the same diagnosis, but aren't necessarily willing to see what it's like on the other side?
Yeah, it's hard, because, I mean, not to call anybody out, but I have family members and I'm like, you know, something is not right. You have depression, you have bipolar, you have something, but, you know, they're not going to address it. It just, you know, it's just how it is to them. And it's just the way it is. They're just not going to address it or anything like that.
Yeah. And going back to them telling you to pray about it, because we know that's a thing in our community, unfortunately. And that's a whole nother episode that we could go into. But what is your response when a family member now, where you are now in life, tells you, well, Stacey, you just got to pray about it. Like, you don't need all these medications. You don't need a therapist. You just need church and Jesus. What is your response?
I kind of ignore them. I kind of ignore them. Thankfully, I don't get it a lot. But I have had it in the past. I know a guy I was dating some years ago told me I didn't need to take medication. All I need to do is exercise.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So that didn't last long. That relationship didn't last long. But.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Ooh,
people just never cease to surprise me.
Yeah. And for a while, he did have me believing that I didn't need to take medication. So I'd actually stopped taking my medication for a while.
Wow. Where was the point where you're like, actually, you don't know what you're talking about. Let me handle this.
I think after we got into an argument or something, And I was like, oh, he just crazy. Let me get back on my medication because I needed to function.
Yeah. I'm glad you figured that out, because that pressure from the people that were in relationships with, or their parents, or you know, our support system, or even like people you work with, even those like little subtle things can really plant like rotten seeds in mm-hmm. our brains, you know, and make us think like, oh, maybe I don't need it. Maybe. And I think part of it is like shame, like the intent, because if you really cared about somebody, you wouldn't be telling them to stop taking medication, which has a whole nother like list of possible side effects that could happen if mm-hmm. you just like randomly stop taking medication. But at the end of the day, I think sometimes people are jealous a little bit when we're like, no, I'm taking care of my mental health. These are the things I'm doing, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, if it's medication, if it's therapy, if it's both, if it's group therapy, however that looks for you. I think sometimes it comes from cultural taboos, as we know in the Black community, mm-hmm. but also like, I think it's a little jealousy of like, I'm not brave enough to do that for myself, so I'm going to shame you out of doing it for yourself.
Yeah, I think so, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Oh, well, Stacey, I appreciate you for coming I appreciate you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was a really great conversation. I really appreciate you being open and vulnerable. I know this is not an easy thing to just be open and like tell a bunch of people about. but I do think that it's important. And when people are ready to tell their stories, I'm like happy to create the space for you. So I appreciate you being vulnerable and talking about all of this journey that you've been on, not just as a mental health professional, but as a Black woman trying to figure out her mental health, trying to navigate having bipolar disorder, and just trying to like live life normally. Mm-hmm. So I just want to thank you for the work that you do in the communities that you work in, but also for coming on here and just like sharing your story with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. And before I forget, cause y'all know, sometimes I forget to run the mind games answer. So we're going to hop into the mind games answer really quick. I'm going to give y'all a little reminder about the who am I of the mind games question for today. So who am I? I am often referred to as the godfather of Black psychology. I am an influential African-American psychologist and social activist. I was one of the first African-Americans to earn a PhD in clinical psychology from Michigan State University in 1961. I co-founded the Association of Black Psychologists in 1968. I was a pioneer in the development of African-centered psychology, and I advocated for the inclusion of African-centered perspectives in psychological theory, research, and practice. Who am I? I am Joseph L. White. So I'm a nerd, so I like doing research on things like this, but it's so interesting because I took like one psychology in college. Y'all know I'm not a mental health professional. I'm just a Black girl with anxiety. But it's so interesting that there are some people like the Sigmund Freuds and he's problematic if you dig into his background, mm-hmm. but all these people that are easy names that we just kind of know when it comes to psychology. But there are a lot of people, a lot of women, a lot of Black people, people of color that have made significant contributions to psychology. And particularly back in like the 60s, when we could barely get into schools, we won't talk about affirmative action being repealed and the fact that it's only going to be harder to, never mind. We're not going to go into that because I will go in a deep rabbit hole, and that's not what we're focusing on. But I am going to start doing more of these because I want us to start to get familiar with these names. I want to start getting familiar with these names because a lot of them I don't know until I like do a deep dive on Dr. Google. And like Joseph L. White, I've never heard of this person, and he's made such big contributions. He's won different awards, such as a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Psychological Association's Society for the Psychological Study of Ethnic Minority Issues, and the American Psychological Foundation's Gold Medal Award for Lifetime Achievement in the Practice of Psychology. He's been a scholar, mentor, and advocate for social justice, and has had a profound impact on the field of multicultural psychology. So I will give y'all some links. Make sure you dive in and get to know him a little bit better. And I'll keep these coming. Hopefully you like them. Stacey, how was that? Was that pretty good?
Yes.
that's a good little education bite. But Stacey, again, thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you so much to everybody that has listened to this episode. I appreciate you guys sticking around to the end. Excited to bring you more great guests, just like the one we've had today, and excited to, I'm just excited. Y'all know I stay excited, but thank you so much for listening. Stacey, if there is anybody that just wants to connect with you, is there an email that you want to share?
Yes, you can email me at Stacey, STACYA Bryce, BRICE, at gmail.com.
Perfect. So I will make sure that's included. If y'all want to connect with Stacey, she's done great work and continues to do great work, both on herself and in the communities that she's been in. So I'll make sure her information's in the description. Make sure y'all are following Black Girls Have Anxiety Too on TikTok, Instagram. It's just at Black Girls Have Anxiety Too. Yes, you have to type the whole thing in. All right. If you want to email me and you want an opportunity to be a part of the podcast, if you're a Black mental health professional, or you are a Black woman that wants to talk about her own journey with your own mental health, email me, blackgirlshaveanxiety2@gmail.com. I'm always looking for new, amazing guests. So thank you again, everybody, and I hope y'all have a wonderful day. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Black Girls Have Anxiety Too. No matter where you are in the world, I really appreciate your support. See you again on the next episode, but until then, follow us on Instagram at Black Girls Have Anxiety Too and on Twitter at Anxious Black Girls. That's Anxious BLK Girls. And remember, just because you're struggling doesn't mean you have to struggle in silence. The more we talk about it, the more we heal.